On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about Hamilton's infrastructure deficit. It's a huge amount that we need to raise to fix our stuff, but where is that money going to come from? Speaking of money, how is it that every single provincial political party is walking around promising billions of dollars in handouts, and nobody, after spending billions and billions of dollars to get through COVID, is talking about maybe showing a little fiscal restraint? And, well, hey, we're talking about money. Do you remember what your first concert was and how much you paid to get in? Times have changed. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We have heard in this city for, I don't know how long now, years, we have heard about the infrastructure deficit this city is facing, that we have all this maintenance to do in the city, roads and buildings and this and that and the other, and the numbers keep going up and up. And the last I heard officially was around 3.2 billion was the number that people were talking about. Well, that seems to still be there. And what do we do about it? Well, one of our city councilors has written something in the Spectator the other day, did write something in the Spectator the other day, Maureen Wilson, Ward 1 councillor, under the headline, let me bring it up here. Hamilton needs a new plan for our bumpy roads, not just our bumpy roads either. Councillor Wilson joins me now. Councillor, thanks for the time today.
Hi, Scott.
Are we still talking $3.2 billion? Is that still a reasonable number, or has it gone up since that was the official total, or do we know?
I believe that is the number, but it grows by about $200 million a year.
A year?
Yep.
So, I mean, it doesn't sound, well, I was going to say, it doesn't sound like we could ever catch up then. I suppose we could catch up, but it would require us to all give a kidney or some other essential organ to sell into the black market to pay for it. I mean, it's a huge amount of money for us to try and catch up and make happen.
It is a huge amount of money, but it is our responsibility as an elected council, first of all, to be forthright with the public about the value of the assets, about the fact that the assets are in trouble, and we are going to be obliged by the provincial government to put a plan in place on how we're going to be dealing with these, with this aging and infrastructure.
So what do we do? Because again, I mean, we could shut things down, I suppose, and not use them or knock them down, but nobody, I don't think, is too eager for that. Or the other option that seems to be is pouring money into it, but that requires taxes, doesn't it? So would that necessarily mean greater taxes?
I guess I'd like to answer both of those points. So I'll take the last one first. I would argue you're paying for it anyway. So let me give you a few examples. As you noted in your introduction, I represent Ward 1, which is in the southwest part of the older city. And there is a roadway that many residents use outside of Ward 1, and it's called Aberdeen Avenue. So just on Aberdeen Avenue, since 2010, there's been 30 water main breaks, 30. And the cost of, let's just say conservatively, or it varies depending on the nature of the break, but say $10,000 a break. So the road itself, if you've ever driven it, yeah, is an exercise in pothole after pothole after pothole. So and I've received emails from residents, and I know many of my colleagues have, that they've had to take their car into the shop because it's bottomed out or the rim has gotten damaged, and that's a chunk of change. And then you're paying for those water main breaks, which do nothing. They're a band-aid. They put a clamp on and hope to, you know, to get through another season. But we're paying for this infrastructure regardless. We're paying when we have to shut down Ryerson pool because the tiles are popping off and represent a health and safety issue. When we cannot use our assets and they're resting dormant, you're paying for the capital regardless, and you're paying for when staff have to show up. So there was a break at Gage and King, a water main break, $100,000 in repair at Highway 5 in Clappison Drive. 30 breaks in 4 years. I would argue the residents are paying for this. but they're not really seeing much of an extension in life, and they're not really seeing much of an enhancement in the asset itself.
No, and look, I think if it was someone's home, I don't disagree with you. I think if it was someone's home and you kept having shingles blow off your roof, at some point you'd say, we need a new roof, as opposed to just patching those shingles. I think a lot of people would say that makes a lot of sense. The challenge becomes, I think, how do we pay for those shingles and that new roof if we also have to pay for our groceries and our electricity bill and our heating and this and that and the other that are all going up? How does the city find the money to do this?
Well, let's step back for a moment. These are indeed, this is a compounded problem. We didn't get to $3.2 billion overnight, and we're not going to solve it overnight. But we have to acknowledge that we're at a point of crisis. It is the primary responsibility of a municipality. Property taxes originally were created to pay for property, services to your property, hard infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And since amalgamation in 2001, 2000, we were at a level of reinvestment in those capital assets that was comparable to other cities and towns across the province. But since that time, we have, to use your comparison, we haven't been setting that money aside. We haven't been making the repairs that house has necessitated, because it's getting older, and it's getting older in some parts more than others. And maybe, to use your house analogy, we have taken on say renovations to our house or extensions when we haven't taken care of some of those core assets. And that's, and I would argue that's negligence. And it's also not fair to the next generation of Hamiltonians, because part of financial equity is ensuring that those future generations are not going to be facing these enormous bills for repairing those deteriorated assets. So the province, under the previous provincial government, and the present Ford government, is continuing to adhere to it. They just had to push out some of the timelines, perhaps because of COVID, but they are requiring all municipalities to come up with a plan on how they are going to attend to these aging to this aging infrastructure. So that is going to have to be a front and center conversation that the next council is going to have to have. And it's going to have to engage the public, and it's going to have to set levels of service. And to your other question, it's also going to have to look at assets that are underperforming and or are not needed. Maybe we have some roads that have multiple lanes that, due to population change or that due to our changing economy, maybe we don't have the same number of workers, for example, going down to our industrial waterfront. Mm-hmm. Every time we keep a road open that is not necessary, we are paying to maintain that road. We're paying to salt that road. We're paying to plow that road. If it's not being used optimally, like perhaps it was when it was first created, then that is on the next council to consider.
We got to run here, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm missing something, but it does seem the options are to cut back on some things or to find new revenues, which generally means new taxes. Is there another option that we have, or is it going to have to be one of those two things?
Well, we're going to have a public conversation on all of those things, but we're going to have to do it strategically. So we're looking for return on our investments, right? So what kind of investments are going to enrich our tax base so that we have a greater capacity to invest in the things that Hamiltonians have told us that matter? And then we're going to have to look at those assets which are not being used to the degree that they have, and is there an opportunity for us to revisit those? And then we're also going to have to use our investment capacity better in partnering with senior orders of government. As I've said, it's a lot cheaper to repair an asset when you've got three wallets at the table. And I mean the federal government, the provincial government, and the municipal government. But you can only do that, Scott, if you've got the financial capacity to bring a third of those dollars to the table and invest in the infrastructure that is going to support our well-being, support those crumbling assets, and also support our ability to compete against other cities and towns in Ontario and beyond that. So it is, rather than hiding from this conversation and not putting in that meager 0.5% every year kind of playing a shell game, we've got to have a public conversation about our financial profile and what we're going to do about it.
The piece is Hamilton needs a new plan for our bumpy roads. You can find it at thespec.com. Maureen Wilson wrote that the other day. It's her argument for what we've just been talking about. Give it a read. Maureen Wilson, thank you for the time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Yesterday, if you were listening to the show, we were talking to Monique Taylor. She's the NDP MPP for Hamilton Mountain. We were talking about the NDP's expansive platform that had just been released in advance of the provincial election. It's massive. Let's be honest. That's what it is. Universal this, universal that, and thousands more nurses and teachers being hired, and post-secondary education costs turned into grants, and thousands of long-term beds and social welfare housing units, and on and on and on. Stephen Del Duca, who's been on this show, leader of the Liberals, has been making the rounds promising this and that every day for the last number of weeks, all that will cost money. Doug Ford has sent you a check for your license renewal stickers to give you that back. And you can be sure that when the budget comes out in the next few days, there will be goodies in there for you as well. The one thing nobody seems to be talking about is fiscal control. Fiscal control, a little reserve, a little holding back on the spending. Ian Lee is an associate professor with the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. He joins us now. Ian, thank you for the time today.
Good evening, Scott.
So as I'm looking at these and hearing these promises and everything else, I got to tell you, maybe it's just because I'm a bit of a fiscal conservative, but is reining in spending to chip away at this growing massive debt that we have, whether provincial or federal, is that just an outdated concept that I am simply out of touch with the rest of the world and it would be ludicrous to talk about such a thing? Or are politicians simply doing what they do?
Right. I'm in agreement with you that it should be a much greater concern. I'm going to give you a different reason, though. It doesn't contradict your concern. It's just I'm going to give a different logic.
Sure.
And that logic is this, and I'm not somebody, I'm a fiscal conservative too, but I don't sit around per se and say, you know, all debt is bad. I don't believe that. Debt, when used prudently, is useful. You know, I bought my house, like millions and millions of Canadians, I bought my house with a mortgage debt, because most people don't walk around with $500,000 or $1 million in their back pocket when they buy their house, and the same with the car. So we buy long-term assets and finance them with long-term debt. But it's a very different story when you're financing consumption with debt. And my analogy is buying your groceries on a credit card, which isn't buying a mortgage. Buying a house on a long-term debt makes sense. Buying your groceries on credit card and then financing it does not make sense. But let me get to my larger point. Right now, as we all know, the governments have experienced a windfall. And both federally and provincially, their deficits came in much lower for the year because the revenues went through the roof. And everyone's saying, isn't that fantastic? Aren't they clever managers? No, no, no. The revenues went through the roof, and they weren't projecting such significant increases because of inflation. And governments in the short run, and the key word to what I just said is short run, governments profit from inflation. When I say profit, they benefit. Because prices go up very quickly when you have inflation. We're all experiencing it right now. Everyone listening knows exactly what I'm talking about. And the HST is priced based on the retail price. The retail price jumped 15%. You're paying a higher HST because the price of the product you bought, the boat, the car, the whatever, has gone up. So in the short run, when inflation suddenly spikes, the revenues gush in to the government, federal and provincial. People say, well, what's wrong with that? Hey, that's great. There's two problems with that. Number one, where does everybody think that money's coming from? It's coming out of your pocket. It's not coming from little green men on Mars. There's no taxpayers on Mars or Pluto or outer space. That money is flowing in, and what every one of us are experiencing, although we don't realize it, is a hidden a pay cut, or if you prefer, it's a hidden tax increase. We are paying more in taxes. The government's, the revenues are flowing in to the federal and provincial government, gushing in. And so their deficits are much lower because the revenues coming in are much higher, and that's coming from every one of us. That's where it's coming from. It's not coming from outer space. It's not coming from Putin or from President Xi of China. It's coming from us, the taxpayers of Ontario or the taxpayers of Canada. Second point, when you have a sudden spike in inflation, and inflation goes up dramatically, you know what's going to happen because we've gone through, we've seen this movie before, and it's been studied by economists for 200-300 years. You know interest rate increases are just around the corner. And we know they're coming. The bank already did it.
They've already started.
And yep. So what's my point? You can say, well, so what? I'm not borrowing. I'm a prudent homeowner, and I don't borrow. Governments do, and they pay the market rate. So when those government bonds, called Government of Ontario bonds, or the City of Hamilton bonds, or the City of Ottawa bonds, or the Government of Canada bonds roll over, because they're borrowing and they're, you know, buying, they're issuing bonds in the marketplace, 1-year bonds, 5-year bonds, whatever. When the bonds mature and they come up for renewal, the government rolls them over. Governments roll them over at the much higher interest rate that has come up in the market. This is exactly what happened in the 80s, culminating in mid-1995 with the Liberal government, where they were on the way I like to put it, it was the hamster on the treadmill. They were running harder and harder to stand still because even though they were cutting spending like crazy during the Mulroney years, people didn't realize that. They were really cutting spending. But what was happening was the interest cost was going up faster than the cutting of the spending. So total spending of the government of Canada went up because interest on the debt is another expenditure of government. And Ontario is the most indebted subnational province.
Yes.
In any place. So when those interest rates catch up to the inflation and we see the rates go up 2-3 points, then the government's cost of borrowing is going to go up and those deficits are going to go back up because the windfall gain from the inflation will have disappeared because of the increased interest rate cost to the government of Ontario for their plus $300 billion of indebtedness.
But here's what I don't get right now, and here's why I bring this up today. Because you said, you know, right now we've got all these revenues that are gushing in. But yeah, we are just coming out of a stretch where all of our money was gushing out because we had to pay people CERB. That's federal, exactly. I know that, but yes, provincially other things. So yes, how is it that nobody seems to say, okay, you know what? We had to do that. We had to take on this massive debt to get us through. But just because we were doing that then, now it's time to start putting some of the grain back in the storehouses to prepare for the next right time something happens, rather than saying, hey, we've already been spending a lot, so let's spend even more. It seems yeah antithetical to common sense.
It's you're right. It's the incentives in the elections, the electoral system in Canada. I mean, it's in other countries too, but we're just talking about Canada. And the politicians are rewarded, or at least they believe that they're rewarded at the ballot box by being elected, their party getting seats, if they go and spend lots of money. And so they're only worried.
Are
they're
they
not worried about 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, 12? Their time horizon is the next election. And if it's 90 days away, that's all they're worried about, is getting past that election and winning more seats. And so the fact that, you know, the chickens are going to come home to roost after they get elected, whichever party gets elected, and they say to themselves, oh, that's another problem for another day. I'll worry about that when it comes. But that doesn't make the problem go away. The inflation I've been arguing for 2 years is the inflation is going to inevitably lead to higher interest rates, which is not only going to affect homeowners and businesses, it's going to affect governments that are borrowers. And the government of Canada now owes $1.34 trillion. Government of Ontario, I believe, is approaching $400 billion. And when those interest rates start to climb because of the compounding effect of interest, and interest, even if the rates are relatively low, you know, 4%, 5%, a low rate of interest, but on a very large amount of money, amortized over a fairly long period of time, generates huge interest payments. This is the logic of mortgages. Why are your mortgage payments so big? Because you're financing it over a long period of time, which means the interest component is very significant. That same problem facing the homeowner faces governments too if they're heavily indebted. And the Governor of Ontario and the Governor of Canada are heavily indebted. That's why Chrétien and Martin did the largest downsizing in Canadian history back in 1995. They had to stop the treadmill, the hamster on the treadmill, where the interest was compounding and growing and growing and growing. So they had to do this massive cutting exercise to rewrite the fiscal policy. And back in 1980, how did they do it? They did it by driving interest rates up to 20%. I'm not predicting that this time. I'm just saying that there's no free lunch, and you end up paying one way or the other.
Ian Lee from the Sprott School of Business, thanks as always for the time. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I'm guessing that every single person listening tonight, right now, at some time or another in their life has gone to a concert. I'd frankly be shocked if you hadn't. Maybe there's a reason why you haven't, but I can't think of why it might be. Everybody at some point must have gone to a concert, and probably, depending on when your concert going habit was at its height, it was, you know, sort of expensive sometimes, but, you know, it was not crazy. Well, let me tell you, the price of concert tickets has gone up. The days of paying just a few bucks to go see some act, long, long, long gone, apparently. According to the Toronto Star, the average concert ticket in Toronto, now that's Toronto, but that's where a lot of us go to see concerts at times. The average concert ticket in Toronto right now, $121. That's the average. So you might get an $8 seat up in the stands and way in the back or something, but you want to get the good seats? Way more than $121. Let me bring in Alan Cross. He is the guy behind A Journal of Musical Things. He is a fantastic music writer. He is a music historian. If there's anything about music that you need to know, Alan Cross is the man to turn to. Sir, how are you this evening?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I'm good. I was thinking about this, and I can remember mine, but I got thinking Alan Cross must have seen 25,000 concerts in his life. Do you remember your first live concert?
Yes, Kiss. Winnipeg,
really?
July 21st, 1978. Opening act, Cheap Trick.
Wow! If you're going to go big, you may as well go big right from the start. That's big time.
That was back in the days of just when we had the over the top theatrical productions. So seeing Kiss at, I guess, how old was I? 15 years old. That's my first show, and it's like, oh my God, this is just amazing.
if they're all like this, I may do a lot more concerts. Now, it turns out they're not. I must tell you, by the way, whenever I go on vacation, one of my rules is I have to read a book while I'm away, and the rule for the book is it must in no way enhance my intelligence or IQ. It is entirely a brain cell destroying book. And a number of years ago, the book that I had with me was The History of Kiss. And I can't remember the name of it. And there were some of the stories of that band are absolutely hilarious, especially when Gene Simmons was first learning to blow fire. You did not want to be around him when he was learning that skill. There were people getting burned up. But yeah, do you remember how much then, 1978, you said? Do you remember how much you paid to go to that concert by chance?
I believe it was $7.
See, that's exactly the kind of thing that that makes this story that we're talking about here just seem, I don't know if it's frustrating or ludicrous or just, hey, it's the times we're in, but we're in way different times. Mine, by the way, I was trying to think what mine might have been, other than the time my parents made me go see Anne Murray at the Forum at Exhibitions Place, which I'm not going to count that one because that was not my choice. I believe it might have been Boston, but I'm not sure if that was first. But, you know, still, I love Boston. Nonetheless, again, probably was $15 once upon a time. Is this all to do with the fact that we're now talking about going from you $7, me maybe $15, to $121 as the average? And yes, inflation factors in, I get that. But is this all to do with the fact that in the last number of years, we don't pay for music anymore? We get it on Spotify or Apple Music, iTunes, whatever. And so this is how the acts now have to make their money, by doing shows?
Yeah. It really begins in 1973 when Led Zeppelin went on a big American tour, and Peter Grant, their manager, demanded that the cut at the gate be changed from the way it used to be, which was, you know, very much in favor of the promoter. And he insisted that the split should be 90-10 to the artist. And Led Zeppelin at that time, 73, 74, was charging, you know, $8, $9, $10 a ticket. Now, $10 for a ticket was a lot of money back then, but Peter Grant insisted that, you know, if I want 90% of that $10. So, and he got it. And this got other acts thinking, saying, well, if Led Zeppelin can extract that much money from touring, well, then we can too. Back then, a tour was often a lost leader. You went on tour to sell records. And if you had a lot of people come see your show, then you sold a lot of records, and that's where you made a lot of money. Everything now has been flipped on its head. Nobody's buying records. You're not making a lot of money from streaming. So touring is where you get the majority of your revenue. And as a result of nobody buying records anymore, and as a result of record labels no longer subsidizing tours or offering tour support, the only people that are paying for these shows are the fans. Now, some things we have to remember is that when you, right now, when you go out on the road, people expect a big extravaganza, you know, lots of sound, lots of lights, lots of video screens, lots of special effects, all these things. That costs money. And all that has to be paid for by the act before they play their first show. So there's a lot of money that's required, seed money, investment money that's required to start a major tour. And part of that is funded by the promoters, and the rest of it is funded by advanced ticket sales. And in order to pay for these big productions that the audience wants, well, you're going to have to charge a substantial amount of money for it. That's one thing. The other thing, too, is that back in the day, you know, paid $20 for a front row seat. You know, further back, you paid $15. Further back, you paid $7. Up in the nosebleeds, you paid $5, something like that. Now, there are way more levels of ticket price. You know, you can spend a couple of $1,000s for a concert ticket that comes with all kinds of VIP access. You might get some swag. You might get a meet and greet. You might get, you know, all kinds of special stuff. So if you have, you know, 500 or 250 tickets at a show that are actually $2,000, that's going to bring up the overall price. So I guess this is a long way around of saying is that $121 average price for a show in Toronto, I'm surprised it's that low. I thought it would be higher.
And you know, when it's funny when you talk about, you know, the nosebleeds, $7 or whatever, as you were saying that, I don't know why this popped to mind. It's not just concerts. I mean, there was a time when I was in high school that we could go to a Jays game on $2 Tuesdays, I think it was, out in the Dominion seats in the bleachers at Exhibition Stadium. And I mean, like $2, you couldn't get a, you can't buy a sip of a beer at the Blue Jays now for $2. But
I used to go to Winnipeg Blue Bombers games, and they had something called the Salisbury House Fun Section. Salisbury House was a chain of diners in Winnipeg, and I remember going to see the Bombers for $1.
Wow! Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's everything. I understand that it's everything, but it really, to your point, then it really puts this value proposition to the test. If you're going to charge this much for tickets, the one thing that I think probably has changed is you'd better be good now. You better have a bunch of songs I like, and you better be good when you get up on stage. I don't know that you can get away with what some bands used to do once upon a time, which was just sort of get up there and let her rip and hope that, you know, it's okay and play 10 songs and away you go. You better put on a show.
You do. People, and they expect the sound to be perfect. They expect the music to sound exactly as it does on Spotify or on the CD. And, you know, lights, costume changes, special effects, all that sort of stuff. That's what people expect. Because it used to be, a bunch of people on stage playing their instruments and going through a bunch of songs. Now a concert needs to be a gigantic theatrical production. And that theatrical production has to it has to be worth it. If you end up paying $150 for a ticket, which is not unusual, and it's a boring show, well, that artist's reputation is ruined in your mind forever. And you're never going to go back and see him. So you got to, you really got to turn in a performance. And that costs
money. Well, yeah. Yeah, because you can't, you know, you may, I suppose you could go around and mail it in if you wanted to, but next time you go on tour, none of those people are coming back. So it's a real pain, a real hit to you the next time when you want to go back into that well.
Yes, it really is. So listen, if you want, you know, if you want like 2.5-3 hours worth of solid entertainment, a good theater production is going to cost you $150. So why shouldn't a concert cost you that same amount of money for the same entertainment value and for that goes on for the same length of time? It's just, for the longest time, really, concert tickets were underpriced based on demand and based on the entertainment value. So we've just caught up, and the reason it caught up was because nobody's selling records anymore. They need to make up that revenue.
If that is the average price, and I have no reason to think that that number is wrong, and as you say, it probably is going to go up because it still is low-ish when you consider, as you just explained, this does create a real meritocracy, doesn't it? That you roll into town and you put the price at a number that can be pretty high. You better be good and you better be popular if you want to have people in those stands, because people can very easily then just say, nope, not interested, because there's a lot of acts that are trying to make some money now after 2 years away with no music from COVID. You'd better be someone that can either price it right or be so popular, or else you could be playing to an empty arena, be really humiliated.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that are going on. First of all, you have to the promoters have to really think about how much demand there is out there. There is, but you know, if there's another wave where people get scared, then you know, tours get canceled or shows get canceled. So it's always this balancing act between how much can I charge and how many bums can I put in seats. And that is that's more voodoo and magic than it is science. You really don't know what's going to happen on a tour based on the economy. You know, we've got right now, there's all kinds of inflation problems. There are issues with COVID. There were, you know, there's so many acts that you've seen that I've seen recently where they've been on tour and they've had to cancel a bunch of shows because one or more members of the band have tested positive. And once that happens, well, everything grinds to a halt. The shows are either canceled or postponed. And then you've got to figure out what you're going to do. An even more tragic situation is with the Foo Fighters. They had all of these shows that were scheduled for this year in Canada, the United States, Europe, and I think even in Australia. These were shows that had been postponed for more than 2 years because of COVID. And out of nowhere, a key member of the band dies. And the issues that come up with that, you know, ticket refunds, ticket insurance issues, you know, all the stuff that happens. So it's very, very expensive to run major tours these days. And like I said, at $121, I'm surprised it's that low.
You make a really good point, Alan, and that is, if I go to buy a ticket to go see a play in Toronto, like one of the top plays at Royal Alec or wherever else, I'm going to pay that much for a decent seat. So why wouldn't you pay that much for a concert? I hadn't thought of it, but it makes sense.
That's what managers and that's what promoters have been saying for the last couple of years, and they're not wrong.
Even more to that for one second is that I might pay $400 to buy a best seat in the house for a Leaf game, and there's no or a Raptors game, and there's no guarantee, A, that the top player is going to play because he could be out or injured or whatever else, or B, that it's going to be a good game. Theoretically, at least, you have some assurance that every concert is going to be pretty close to the last one, which means you've heard something about it, which means it's probably pretty good. You've got some assurance of that.
You do. That's right. I mean, the last thing you want to do is go to a Leaf game and they stink out the joint. And you're thinking, I spent, you know, $400 on this ticket, and I spent, you know, $15 for a beer, and then I spent $8 for a hot dog. Are you kidding me? Plus, you know, parking or a babysitter or whatever else. So, yeah, you know, in the grand scheme of things, a concert is still a really good, is really good value. One other thing I should probably point out, and I mentioned it briefly earlier, is this idea of insurance. We've had some issues over the last number of years where people have been hurt or killed at concerts and festivals. And, for example, we had the Astroworld disaster in Houston back in November. And now there were all these lawsuits. There are 3,000 lawsuits that have been filed as the result of that particular situation. And if you can't go on tour without somebody underwriting the insurance on things. And when you have something like that happen, the insurance companies that specialize in concert and festival insurance, I mean, they look at their actuarial tables and they go, ah, sorry, risk has gone up and the price goes up. And the price goes up for everybody to distribute the risk among all the people that are buying insurance. And that inevitably filters down to the price of a concert ticket.
Hmm. Just before I let you go, and maybe you're the wrong guy to ask this of because, again, you've been to so many concerts, but is there, years ago, I said to myself, and my wife and I are probably talking or something, and I said, you know what, because concerts are expensive, there's one or two that I would be willing to sort of spend whatever. If that person goes on tour, yeah, it's going to cost me a lot of money, but for that one, I will spend whatever it takes. And actually, I lucked out because the one that I really wanted, Paul McCartney, ended up coming to Hamilton and was able to see him. Is there somebody that you would say that for? That's the one act that I would pay. I don't care what it is. I'll go.
Paul McCartney.
That's the one?
So you've seen him, and you know that at certain points in the show, especially when he starts playing Hey Jude, people jump out of their wheelchairs and throw away their crutches, and everybody has this amazing spiritual moment. I can honestly say that I have never been more entertained than the times when I've seen Paul McCartney in concert. Honest to God.
Well, because you're right, and one of the things, and I don't want to make this whole discussion about Paul McCartney, but everybody in the entire place, maybe, you know, he played one or two new songs that not everybody knew, but 98% of what he played, everybody knows every word to every song. They're easy to sing along with. They're totally familiar. And it's this communal experience, which is fun because we don't do that. You know, the only place in society, there's two places in society now where you sing together, a soccer game or church. And a lot of people don't do either. So a concert, a Paul McCartney concert, is the only place.
Yeah, I'm going to see him in June in Boston at Fenway Park. And apparently Fenway Park is a great place to see a show because you can get really, really close to the stage. So once again, you know, he's going to play 38, 39 songs in his set. I'm going to know 38 or 39 of them.
Yep.
And they're Beatles songs. And he's the last. Well, he's not the last Beatle, but he's the greatest.
Ringo Starr's catalog is not quite as extensive.
Not quite as deep. I mean, Octopus's Garden, and you know, with a little help from
Yellow Submarine.
Yeah, Yellow Submarine. That's fine, great. But with McCartney, he sings some of the greatest songs that have ever been written in the history of humanity. He's there in front of you, and he's not going to be with us for very much longer. He's 79 years old. And he's got, but he's still got the energy, and he's got this amazing band that have been with him for years.
Yes,
and it just wipes away the years. It is just, I mean, I tear up talking about it because it's so good.
It is, I'm now envious that you're going to do that. I'm a. Boston, huh? Hmm. Alan Cross, love having you on to talk about this stuff. Thanks for the time, as always.
You're very welcome.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.